traditional 10 minutes beyond whatever time we set to start the meeting. We are going to start with a work session on Senate Bill 18.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 18A comes to you from the Oregon Advocacy Center through the Joint Judiciary Committee, directs the Department of Human Resources to ensure that designee conducting investigation of alleged abuse of mentally ill or developmentally disabled adult has training and consultation and conduct thorough and unbiased investigation. Requires that training address the cultural and social diversity of the state, includes within the definition of abuse of mentally ill neglect that leads to physical harm through withholding of services necessary to maintain health and well-being. You have the dash A4 amendments in front of you. You may remember the testimony before the committee on the 28th of April concerning what about if we didn't have enough money to provide the services. And what you have before you is the A4 amendments, which says, for the purpose of this paragraph, neglect does not include a failure of the state or a community program to provide services due to a lack of funding available to provide the services. The county people, DHS, and Oregon Advocacy Center have met on this language and have all agreed on this language. What it basically says, if you don't have the money, you can't provide the services, you're not neglecting someone.
Okay. Why don't we have Mr. Junduf, if you'd come up, and who's going to come up for the counties?
Gina,
okay. Is there anybody?
Yes.
Who is our third?
It was Jim Russell. I forget the lady's name here. That from.
Great, from DHS. And the A4 amendment is an agreed-to amendment among all the parties. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Junduf from Oregon Advocacy Center. That's correct. We've met, and we were able to agree that this language meets all of our requirements.
Gina, you want to go on record for the counties on this?
I certainly will. For the record, my name is Gina Furman. I am the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. While we have some problems with this bill in general, we have agreed to sit down. We agree to this language. And one of the things that DHS and Oregon Advocacy Center and us have agreed to do is during the interim look at not only this bill but other things that may have other problematic areas and go through them and relook at everything that has to do with mental health. So with that, we concur with this particular amendment.
Okay.
My name is Eva Kutush. I'm representing Department of Human Services, and we agree with what's been said.
Okay, great. Are there any questions for any of the panel on either Senate Bill 18 or the Dash A4 amendment? Okay, thank you very much. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move the Dash A4s into SB 18.
Representative Przanski moves the Dash A4 amendments into Senate Bill 18. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The A4s are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move Senate Bill 18 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 18 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Nancy, call the roll.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excused.
Szymanski.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Excused.
Kimberly.
Aye. The Senate Bill 18, as amended by the A4s, is adopted and goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Carrier.
Need a carrier. Bob, you want to take it? Okay. Representative Jensen. And I'd encourage both the counties and Mr. Junduf and DHS to work with Representative Jensen on a floor statement on the bill. Okay. Representative Ackerman, let me count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We got a quorum. So
I'll stick by it for.
You want to stick around? Okay. He's not feeling well today, so we're going to excuse him when he feels like he needs to leave. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 348. Thank you. Council, you want to...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 348A deals with... Make sure I've got a gross copy. Deals with people who are driving while under the influence of intoxicants, who have a passenger who's under the age of 18, who is also 3 years younger than the person driving the motor vehicle. It increases the fine for such a person for up to $10,000. It also, looking at Section 2 of the bill, there are, for a DUI diversion, which as you all know is the program that if you enter diversion, do your alcohol and drug rehabilitation program, no conviction is entered. You would not be eligible for that, and you would have to proceed to resolve your case normally if you were driving the vehicle under the influence and you did have a passenger who was under 18 years of age and was 3 years younger than the driver.
Okay, I have two witnesses signed up. Eric Van Hagen, if you want to come forward. We'll begin with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Eric Van Hagen, legislative assistant to Senator Metzger, who couldn't be here with you today. He and I have been working on this legislation for a while, and I'll just be very brief, as I know this issue has been before you in other bills, so you probably have some context for the problem of DUIs with children in the vehicle. As counsel said, this bill just does two things, increases the fines and creates ineligibility for diversion. We had originally written this into child endangerment statutes and amended the bill, which is what brings you to the A engrossed version from the Senate. And we feel this is a good way to address the issue without some of the problems of fiscal impact due to increased prison times. This retains the offense as a Class A misdemeanor. And we viewed it as a feasible method of dealing with this problem in this session, and we urge your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Further questions? We'll start with Representative Przanski, then Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need some clarification as to the history regarding the potential of eliminating the diversion option for an individual that finds himself in that situation. And my concern is that knowing that when the diversion program was originally started and established, it was to give individuals the opportunity to learn from that mistake without being penalized excessively, and also the concern about single parents, specifically women, who may find themselves in this situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I think that's a very good discussion for the committee to consider that aspect of this. I think our feeling coming into this is a way to make a statement about the severity of the issue. If you look at the existing statutes in terms of what qualifies for ineligibility for diversion, it's death of a person other than the defendant or physical injury to a person other than the defendant. But there are also restrictions for eligibility in terms of whether a person has had prior convictions within the last 10 years. So essentially making this the equivalent of a second DUI to be ineligible for diversion.
I understand what it will do.
Right.
But I guess, was there discussion on the Senate side as to the ramification of really modifying what was the extended purpose and policy in establishing diversion, and what impact it may have adversely on single parents? And specifically in the cases I prosecute, there are many women who unfortunately have their children with them, where there's it could be to stop for a traffic infraction, such as a headlight out or a taillight not operating, as compared to being reckless, endangering, or in their driving.
Chair Williams, Representative Przanski, we did not have that discussion in committee, to the best of my knowledge. But as I said, we'd be happy to consider amending the bill if there was sufficient interest.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Przanski was getting at maybe better than I was going to the question or issue that I had. I was a little interested in why the 3 years younger, and recognizing that the 3 years younger would automatically include any parent that might be there. And I also had the concern regarding the lack of diversion. At least if I understand diversion programs, they are to try to begin some process of rehabilitation of these people from what we would normally identify, I guess, as a drinking problem. And that would seem to me to be probably the wrong thing for us to be doing, sort of thing. So I would have that basically Representative Brzezinski's concerns with the bill as it's currently written.
Council had a
comment. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen. I have an answer to two things. The diversion piece, as I recall, this bill was not in it originally. I believe it was in one of the other bills, Eric, that another representative might have introduced and was added in the amendments. I do remember that. The issue about the 3 years was something that I raised. The 3 years is the age defense that would be in any of these sexual crimes that are statutory. And my recollection when I was helping Senator Metzger craft this was that last session we had a similar bill. And that was one of the issues that came up in committee is you wouldn't want to have a 18-year-old and his 17-year-old brother be dealing with this. And so it was going to be limited to a situation where it was an adult and a person 3 years younger.
Thank you. If I could, Mr. Chair, follow up.
You may.
That was more or less my suspicion of the 3 years. But I guess with that suspicion, I wondered if that may not have clouded the vision that we were, you know, looking at, especially as it relates to the provision for the diversion program.
What was the, if I could ask Mr. Van Hagen, what was the committee's sense, as you recall, as to why no diversion in this particular instance?
Mr. Chair Williams, I believe the ineligibility diversion was, I guess, in terms of our search, counsel was right. This was not in the original bill because this is sort of an amalgamation of a couple of different bills related to this issue that have been introduced in this session. And our attempts to craft something that was that made a strong statement about the seriousness of the issue and without creating any sort of a fiscal impact through additional burdens on prisons through increased jail time. This was a means by which we could increase the severity and make a statement about the seriousness of this problem.
Council, and then I'll go to Representative Shirley and Representative Barker.
Representative Shirley, Mr. Chairman, just what I recall is that it was just considered an aggravating factor, like, you know, certainly not as severe as killing a person, but because there were other bills that had this and they wanted to get there were bills that would put this in recklessly endangering. I think that was the thought. I mean, I think that was the conversation that we had in the committee.
Representative Barker?
I just got to say, you know, if you get in an accident and hurt somebody, you can't go to diversion.
Right.
So, and I think my impression is what they're saying is going down the store to get another bottle of wine while you're drunk with your kids is serious, and it's not something we're going to overlook. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I think that's the purpose behind that.
And I guess I'd say the balance seems to me that, I mean, my recollection, and I don't know the numbers, you sort of have two categories typically of the DUI type, and you would know this better than I, Representative Barker, but you have that group of people who are sort of the offender that gets caught, they go through diversion, and they're done.
Yeah.
And then you got the chronic that, you know, you put them through diversion, and it doesn't make a difference, and you get them two or three more times before something really serious happens, and maybe they finally go to jail for some period of time. It seems to me that the occasional person, you know, without condoning anything that they're doing, it could still be that person who drank too much at the company picnic as they were now driving home with the family, gets pulled over, and would benefit and maybe be entirely resolved by having the benefit of that diversion program. And I'm just wondering, again, if we're, you know, if we're cinching this thing down to a point where we're going to pick up a whole lot of people who would have fundamentally benefited from the whole purpose in offering diversion in the first place, simply because of an aggravating factor. Not that I don't think that the factor is pretty significant. And, you know, it's... Yeah. Okay. Representative Fairley.
Yeah, no, I think I'm going where you're going. It seems to me that the purpose of diversion was to recognize that at least the first offender, more than anything else, we want to make sure we get that person into a treatment program and get this problem dealt with. And I'm not sure that mixing punitive with that under these circumstances necessarily achieves the purpose and could undermine the purpose of the diversion program.
You're about where I am, which is that I'm not sure I'm all the way there yet, but I'm troubled that we're sort of lumping this concept into a basis upon which we're going to... I mean, either we ought to have diversion or we ought not to have diversion, and that's a whole subject I'm willing to entertain, but it just seems... I'm not sure this one cuts it in a manner that I think you don't pick up a whole lot of people who would otherwise have benefited and gotten that wake-up call that they would need.
I'm being convinced about that as well, but I think the thing Representative Jensen brought up a while back in another bill is that diversion ought to count as a click if they have a subsequent conviction, and I would feel much better about all this if we had that in place, but we didn't put it in place because of the financial impact this session.
Representative Przanowski?
But I think we actually have the first part of that bill that will address some of those concerns. Because if we enhance the penalty for a conviction when there is a child in the vehicle, we're going to get the person on their second time. Because if I remember correctly, on diversion, I'm guessing, but I think at least 80% of the people who go through diversion, you never see coming back through the court on those type of...
I don't know if it's that high, but it's significant. I mean, it's worthwhile.
Council may know that number.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pransky, I think that, I mean, that it's hard to calculate. As I recall, I would say it's about 60% complete diversion successfully. And it's always hard to get what that statistic means. Does that mean they never have another incident? I'm not sure on that. I think it's hard to... exact number.
Ms. Russell may know some of those numbers. I don't know if you do or not, but we'll bring her up here in a minute.
Our success rate through our court seems to be better than that. But either way, they get that opportunity, and then if they slip, make that mistake, and they're on notice. And clearly, the substantial moving the fine up to $10,000 should get a message across very quickly for those on the second one. And we could always come back and revisit this. I mean, if this seems to be not getting the message out, that's why I wanted to know what the discussion was, because I understand the policy of saying we want people to be very conscious of what they're doing and the risks that are there. But at the same time, it does really seem like it's going against what the policy of this body put together when they first had diversion in place for trying to get early recognition and get them through a program.
And I know we've had some incidents here recently where we've seen tragedies involving drunk drivers that have had children, their own and other people in the car. In the situations, obviously, that we're aware of, there have been physical injuries or deaths to where that individual wouldn't be subject to any kind of a diversion program anyway. I mean, so I'm not sure that that's not picking up sort of those most egregious examples that we're already aware of. Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is a little on different tack, but interested in your rationale as to why you went from 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, and then to 10,000. Seems like a pretty healthy jump.
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, I don't know if it does not follow the logical progression in terms of the rates in which the fines are increased. We worked with council. We looked also at a number of different states who have, I believe there's close to 25 or so now, that have implemented some sort of enhanced penalties and explored their bills, and this seemed to be sort of in line with what had been done in a number of different places.
Is that sufficient, Representative Anderson? Representative Przanowski?
Well, the reality, this is a Class A misdemeanor, so the maximum fine currently is $5,000. These are minimum fines based on the number of convictions. So what we're doing is we allow the court to take into consideration a higher maximum fine, and it does not have to actually give the $10,000 fine. It could be anywhere, but it has to be at least the minimum based on the number of convictions.
Representative Cherilyn.
Well, thanks. This raises an interesting question in the drafting. In the current language, those are mandatory fines in sub 6. This is on lines 3 through 8. In addition to any other sentence, the court shall impose a fine, and then it has that dollar amount on each of those orders of conviction. And then sub 7 says, notwithstanding some other statute, the court may impose a fine of up to $10,000. So is that $10,000 in addition to the mandatory fine?
No, I the way I would read it, and I may be reading it wrong, but I would...
Well, if it's your second conviction and you had a child in the car.
I would say that the maximum, it says may impose a fine up to a $10,000 on a person convicted of driving while under the influence. So up to, I think, would include whatever the underlying fine is, plus an amount up to $10,000 if you wanted to... If you wanted to get to that number,
Mr. Chairman.
Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Shirley, I wanted to point out that that's the statute. ORS 161635 says that the maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor is $5,000.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change the fact, I think, that if it's...
I understand.
For a person's second conviction, $1,500, and then under this one, notwithstanding the $5,000 limitation, you can impose a fine of up to 10, and I'm not. I think you would have to aggregate them as it's written.
I think you would have to aggregate.
Yeah.
I think so. You'd have to put 1,500 plus whatever you impose under sub 7.
Not to exceed $10,000, because it uses the language as up to.
I'm looking at sub 6. In addition to any other sentence that may be imposed, that's how line 3 starts out. You've got this 1,000, 1,500, 2,000.
But is this a different sentence?
I don't know how that fits in.
I don't either. What was the intent? Was the intent to go whatever the base charge for either a third or a second conviction amount plus an additional $10,000, or was it to be that amount plus up to a maximum of $10,000?
Chair Williams, I believe it was... my understanding was our intent was to have an additional $10,000 for the infraction of driving under the influence with children in the vehicle.
Okay. So if I interpret...
No. Representative
Jensen. If I interpret that correctly, then that we're talking about a maximum fine here of a second offense under the conditions of 7 of $12,500. Or $11,500.
Right.
That would...
And then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Crummell,
this may sound like a flip question, and it's not intended that way. But going on in line 11, it says, it's driving while under the influence of intoxicants if the current offense was committed in a motor vehicle, and then the passenger being under 18. My question is, can a person be convicted of a DUII not in a motor vehicle?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
So how would that be?
Buoy, biking under the influence of intoxicants.
Boating.
Boating.
Actually, boating has its own
separate.
But a boat is actually a motor vehicle, isn't it?
Right, but a bike is
not as
defined. It is a buoy, but it's actually, we call it buoy, biking under the influence.
Oh, okay.
Certain things don't happen, like you can't require somebody to take the breath test if they are stopped on a bike riding under the influence. But it is a bike is a vehicle under the traffic code.
Yeah. But not a motor vehicle.
Okay. What if they are just walking? I mean, they're walking down the street, they're
we
falling
don't do
down drunk.
No, Wooey. You can walk with your children drunk.
Yeah,
no Wooey.
Pack them on your back. And
no public intoxication prohibition yet.
Anymore.
Down the middle.
Yeah. Anymore, right.
Anymore, yeah.
So that's why the language is there, and then over on page 3, line 3, that it has to be that the current offense that they're being charged with has to be in a motor vehicle, but it would be added into any other. So if they were in fact on a bike and were charged with a buoy, as you say, then that would actually create the first conviction.
Yeah. It registers as a conviction for being under, you know, operating a vehicle under the influence. But it would not kick in the enhanced penalty if, let's say, you're on a tandem or something where you had your child on the back or whatever.
We're stretching here.
Well, that's a good point.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So,
that's a good point.
In essence, it sounds to me like we... If we're going to live up to the intent, we need an amendment on line 9, notwithstanding ORS 161.635, and subsection 6 of this
340
bill, and a court may impose an additional fine up to $10,000.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what I'm still frankly unclear of in the language. I mean, if that was the intent, I think then it probably is going to have to get clarified if that's what the committee decides we want to do, because I think you could read that in a way of having to beg the question of whether that $10,000 is an additional or whether it is a maximum amount that you have to take the other, you know. I don't know whether or not this would be considered a separate sentence, and so you could parse it out. And so we'll just have to get there. But I've asked Craig to ask Virginia to come up from Legislative Council. We can talk through the issue with her a little bit. We have some other bills on the agenda, though, so we can come back to this one in a minute, and I want to still allow Ms. Russell to come up and testify. Are there any other questions for Mr. Van Hagen?
If I could just make, we would gladly, if there was an emerging consensus by the committee back to the diversion subject, you know, we'd be happy to make amendments there. As I said, that would, okay, you know, at the direction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And tell Representative Metzger next time we expect him to be brave and actually come talk to us about his bill.
Thank you.
Susan?
Good afternoon. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here in part opposition to Senate Bill 348, and our concern is with the diversion aspect of it. A couple background matters. It was my recollection in the Senate, there was concern when the bill was first presented that it was providing this new crime of reckless endangering when a child was present, and so there was a problem with sort of basically having a strict liability standard in a reckless statute. When it came back on for a work session, I think that counsel is correct that there was this new idea of having an enhanced fine, and then this diversion position was, diversion exclusion was sort of tacked on to this bill. It had been present in some form in another bill. I was present in the work session and can recollect that there was not a great discussion about the diversion aspect. There was simply sort of an explanation and that was it, and no testimony was taken on that aspect. With respect to this diversion exclusion, we do have a grave concern, and we do oppose it strongly in that the OCDLA feels that it's going to, I think as some of the members have already said, that it's going to be sort of counterproductive in terms of what the objective is. The objective is to get parents not to be driving with their children in the car. I think as the chair has, you know, sort of given as a hypothetical, there's a big difference from someone who's a chronic alcohol who takes shots of vodka before they get into a car with their children on a regular basis and someone who's in a picnic and has a couple beers. Under current law, if anyone is injured, and I think Representative Barker has already pointed out, they're automatically excluded from diversion. But in addition, the court has a general discretion to disallow anyone from diversion for any reason whatsoever. So it's my position that if we're talking about this chronic alcohol who's arrested and the officer or the district attorney presents information that this individual is very drunk and has behaved in this really sort of outrageous way or driven in a way that's really endangered children, that in and of itself under current law is already a basis in which the court could exclude someone from diversion if it was if the court found that was appropriate. I tried to find out some information about the diversion programs and relative recidivism rates between people being put on probation and people successfully completing diversion. What I did find out is that statewide is that the diversion program has a success rate of around or a little above 70%. So that's a pretty high success rate. I mean, it's still, unfortunately, a 30% failure rate, but it's a fairly high success rate for people that participate. And my experience has been that people that fail, that don't succeed in diversion, they succeed quite quickly, meaning that they fail out and don't engage in alcohol treatment. There are people that, of course, a smaller percentage that drag on and don't, but that most people that are either going to engage or succeed are going to do it so pretty quick up front. So I see some questions.
I guess one of the questions, and I'll ask and then we'll go around, but the definition of success, obviously, on a program is always one that you have to, and typically I know, it's tough because everybody uses sort of a different statistic or a method of measuring recidivism, for example, but
Correct. By
successfully completing diversion, are we tying that to they are not picked up on another DUI offense for 12 months or 48 months or 5 years, or is it just the people who've actually completed the program and we don't check to see what happens after the program completion date?
And, Mr. Chair, is that that 70% success rate is that they succeed in the program, and I believe the program is on average a year. Sometimes it extends to a year and a half. It is a very intensive program in terms of it being treatment-based. There's sort of phases, three phases. It may differ from county to county of sort of intense and less intense sort of alcohol treatment aftercare. So that is the success rate in terms of the 70 plus percent success rate. I tried to find out whether there were statistics by asking a number of people and having someone check with DMV to see whether there were comparisons in terms of recidivism. Having successfully completed diversion, is somebody who successfully completed diversion less likely to acquire a subsequent DUI than somebody who's been placed on probation, been convicted and placed on probation? And there are no statistics that make that comparison, unfortunately.
Okay. Representative Jensen, you had another question, I think?
You've asked my question.
Okay. Representative Barker.
My anecdotal thing would be that diversion is much better than if you just got convicted the first time in a probation, because of the process you go through having to meet with the victims panels and so on is very helpful. But I was just going to say, as far as successful completion, my daughter was prosecuting a trial recently where they said, "But Your Honor, my client successfully completed diversion 2 years ago, and so this subsequent drunk thing ought to be treated very nicely." And so I would say they didn't complete it successfully if they're back doing it again. But that's a good, based on just completing 70% is a very good number, and I'm happy with that.
Okay. Any other questions for Susan? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, come on, this is going to be more fun if we get to do it before she knows what the question is. Don't coach her, counsel. That's no fun at all. If we're going to pull Virginia out of her office unexpectedly, we at least get the pleasure of surprising her with the questions.
Okay.
You're ruining the only fun of the afternoon, Craig. Virginia, we are sorry to yank you out. On Senate Bill 348, the question arose, and I'll blame Representative Shetterly for it.
Works for me.
Yeah, right. On page 2, it talks about the fine amounts, and fundamentally the question is the $10,000, if you aggregate with the earlier conviction amounts for a third or a second or a first conviction, or is the $10,000 a maximum amount given those aggravating factors? So it would be $1,500 if it's your second conviction, Plus, they could go up to $10,000 total, but no more than $10,000.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt Legislative Council's office. Yeah, this is fun, but actually, I had the TV on, so I...
You knew it was coming.
I sort of had a feeling that it was coming. Because...
What were you shouting at the TV as you were...
You know, I wasn't shouting anything at the TV, which is unusual, because usually I am in these kinds of situations. But unfortunately, I could see the reason for the confusion. And I say unfortunately because, of course, I drafted this, so I kind of hate to have to admit that, but... I believe the way this is written with subsection 7, that $10,000 would be the maximum amount that you could impose. Mm-hmm. The crime is a Class A misdemeanor, which has a $5,000, you know, normal maximum. And so we have to notwithstand 161.635, and I believe that, you know, we notwithstand the $5,000 limit. We say you can impose up to $10,000. Under these particular circumstances, I do not think that statutorily you would be able to impose, you know, $11,000 or $11,500 if it was a second conviction.
Representative Shetland.
Well, except, but especially with that reference back to 161.635, mm-hmm. which is what establishes the fine for the misdemeanor.
Right.
Clearly, in sub 6 above, that is in addition to your standard misdemeanor fine, because it says in addition to any other sentence, so I assume that's in addition. It's
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, no, I don't believe so. I believe that the purpose or the effect of subsection 7 is to say, you know, in addition to whatever else the court imposes, the court has to impose a minimum of these amounts for first, second, and third convictions, but it doesn't authorize them to impose $5,000 plus that extra one or whatever.
Representative Prasansky.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, if, based on how Lane's reading this, if would it make any sense or more sense to put subsection 7 before subsection 6 for clarity, that we're basically saying that under these circumstances it's what the maximum is and then have an addition underneath that, or is that...
Well, I would say that, excuse me, Chair Williams, Representative Prasansky, we sort of would hate to have to rely on just the pure placement of the sections for the legal meaning of the statute. And so I would just suggest that depending upon the policy decision that you want to make, whether you want, in fact, to be able to impose a fine that is higher than $10,000 if this is a subsequent conviction, that we could say that. Otherwise, I believe that it's pretty straightforward when you read it in the context of the maximums that are normally imposed and this authorization to the court to exceed that, but only up to $10,000.
I read it your way.
Yeah, as did I.
Lane's out of the room. We can move forward.
well,
beg
I think.
Your pardon.
I mean, I think the question is, what do we really want to do? But I want to make sure that you've all got your questions answered. So, if it was the policy decision to say the $1,500 plus an additional $10,000, we would need to amend the language to do that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we at least know the parameter. If that's the choice we want to go, then that has to be amended.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all we have. Anything else for Ms. Vanderbilt? I'm sorry, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lacking the formal training that some people have as they read these, and certainly that Ms. Vanderbilt has, but supposing I draw a judge that has a bad case of indigestion and that doesn't happen to particularly like me, and he says that will be $1,500 plus $10,000. How much is it going to cost me to appeal this?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, I can't answer that.
And as a consequence, Mr. Chair,
yes,
if this is our intention, I'd like it to be, I'd be more comfortable if it were more specific.
If it were more specific. So you'd actually like the language to be even further clarified than it currently reads.
Right.
Okay.
Either it's, yeah.
All right. So if we want to stick at a maximum of 10,000,
yeah,
you'd still like it to say a maximum of.
Right. Okay. A maximum fine right. Of up to.
Okay. So we could get an amendment either way. And we'll let you know. We'll let you know what we're going to do at some point, Virginia.
And
my television will be on.
Thanks.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It is with great reluctance that I make any question about amending the clarity of Virginia's legislation.
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, any help that I can get is appreciated.
Well, Craig's the one who's going to be in trouble, so all we care about.
All right.
Thanks, Virginia. We appreciate you coming up. Okay. Okay.
Since we're going on the King Trust.
Sure. It's counsel's suggestion. I don't want to. But in talking about this matter, I did reference...
Can you identify yourself again?
Susan Russell from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In talking originally about the diversion program, I think we've had some discussion. There are some matters that automatically disqualify defendants, such as that there's injury caused through the driving. There's also, as I said, sort of a general discretion that the court has in determining whether to admit someone, and that's under ORS 813.220. And these include things such as shall consider whether the diversion will be of benefit to the defendant and the community, may take into consideration whether there was an early recognition of a drinking problem, may take into consideration whether there's probability that the defendant will cooperate with the diagnostic assessment and treatment agencies, and other matters such as that. And just speaking with counsel briefly, another alternative, rather than making someone automatically disqualifying an individual from the diversion program, would be to add another factor that the court may take into consideration whether there were minors in the car.
As a basis of potential objection. That seems to open the door maybe a little broader than having no diversion, I mean, than not addressing it at all. And putting it on the list. Representative Prozanski?
Yeah, and the prosecutor always, when these individuals come to the court, they have 30 days from the date of arraignment to file the petition, and then the prosecutor's office gets an opportunity to raise an objection if they want to, and the reasons that have been just stated from the statute is what we would be relying on as to doing it. And if the court, if we think as a policy, we want the court to take in consideration with children being in the car, that would probably be the place most appropriate to allow that instead of just an outright prohibition. It seems like we'd accomplish maybe some of the stuff that the senator's office would like to make certain the court is considering, or let's say more aware of, not that they couldn't take that in consideration now.
All right. That's helpful. Thank you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 348A. And I'm going to go into work session, not for the purpose of moving the bill, but I just want to have a brief committee discussion and get people's sense so we can direct counsel on the amendments. What's the sense on the issue that was just raised about putting the factor of the children on the list of things that the court has to consider for diversion purposes? And then I'd like to get some direction about the amount of the fine, whether we want to... Well, recognizing that we'll want to clarify one way or the other, but what do we want to do as a matter of policy? Do we want to say $10,000 plus, or do we just want to say up to a maximum of $10,000, including the underlying offense charge? Thoughts?
$10,000 max. I think it seems the easiest.
Yeah, I would say to a maximum as well, right? As opposed to giving the discretion of adding on here and adding on there, and pretty soon you've got it up to, you know, to a much higher amount. Okay. It's up to a maximum of 10,000, and then it's
fair for the judge as
right.
Well.
And right. In the practice in courts, in these type of cases, you normally do not see someone being maxed out on the fines. And that's why I think you actually have the minimums in there to make that policy decision. There's still right. A lot of flexibility in giving an extra 5,000 on top of what
right.
Currently is the maximum.
Okay.
I don't have any problem with that.
All right, great. All right, then I think counsel will have you draft amendments. that makes that change on the diversion issue and then gets a clarifying amendment from Virginia to solve any concern about whether or not that is an aggregated amount or not.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Yes.
All right. Then we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 348. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628 and ask Scott Taylor to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 628A, as Scott's coming up, is a bill that deals with confidential records of child abuse. And my understanding of this bill is it addresses an issue that came up with a certain some legal opinions that a law enforcement agency that is writing its own reports could not share those reports if they were investigating child abuse because of the statute, meaning there was concern about using allowing the law enforcement to share with other law enforcement. So if you look at the second page 2 of the bill, beginning with line 5 of page 2, it allows a law enforcement agency to make reports available to other law enforcement agencies, DAs, city attorneys, criminal prosecution functions, which are necessary for investigation or enforcement of laws relating to child abuse and neglect. Subsection 4 on page 9, this allows after the closing of a file on a specific case relating to child abuse or neglect, allows the agency that made the investigation to let other law enforcement agencies or corrections agencies use those if they are needed for the purpose of managing and supervising offenders in custody or on release, and that would be only upon request of that supervising or managing agency. And then down on line 26, sub B, notwithstanding paragraph A of this subsection, the agency, corrections agency, DOC, or Board of Parole may disclose records made available to them under the above section. And again, this is for the purposes of managing and supervising offenders in custody or on probation, parole, or post-prison supervision. And that would only be to each other and to other law enforcement agencies.
Welcome, Mr. Taylor, and maybe you can sort of just give us a description of the problem that this bill is intended to solve.
Thank you, Chair Williams. For the record, my name is Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections. The problem that we currently experience, as Mr. Prinz laid out, is that we receive individuals that are on supervision. These records, we do not have access to records, and current interpretation is that we cannot be given access to these records. So we're managing people who may have been involved in a variety of child abuse events that we supervise as sex offenders, or we have as conditions of supervision, or we have in our institutions, and we're not sure what the events were or what issues to address. So as we assess them, as we try to determine what the risk factors are with different offenders, and we try to look at the predatory behavior and their sex offenses against children, and when we talk about who we can put out on work crews or if we should have visitation from certain children or not, we don't know this information. And so it hinders our ability to manage that population. It also, as we move to then transition from the prison to the community, and during that supervision, we may not be aware of conditions that we should have on that individual, the special conditions to manage that. And that leaves us then to trust the individual to give us an accurate report of what the events were, if there were events, and we find that not to be the most appropriate way to gather our information.
Okay. Are questions for Mr. Taylor on what the bill does?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Trumbull.
If a person is a suspected or being accused of child abuse, can they view the records that are kept on them themselves?
Chair Williams, Representative Trumbull, I do not know the answer to that question.
Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krummel, one answer for the police reports, if it's a police agency, no. The other issue is with DHS, their reports, and I think the answer for that is no as well. Those are confidential and are not, if you look at accessible for public inspection under the 419B035, DHS would not be able to give those to anyone other than those that are mentioned in there.
So just out of curiosity, how does a person defend themselves against allegations if they can't get information about the allegations being made against them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think DHS would have to be able to have a full conversation about that, because no one, they're kept within DHS, and so, I mean, I think DHS does not investigate child abuse for the purposes of prosecution. They hand it over to the police. So in my experience, DHS was a starting point, and if there was a founded possibility of child abuse, they would hand it over to law enforcement. Law enforcement, after that case is closed, you could get those reports possibly, but I think that there's... I don't think I'm the person to answer it on the DHS end of it. I think it's I think it would be difficult to get those reports, though.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for Mr. Taylor on the bill? Scott, there were some amendments adopted in the Senate. Is that right? Was there any Senate opposition at first that required the amending of the bill, or were there just some technical corrections?
I think they were originally just some corrections. I think originally the defense bar had some concerns. I think those were addressed.
Okay.
As the bill currently stands.
All right. Thank you. There's no one else that has signed up on this bill. So before I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 628, is there anyone else here to testify? All right. We're closing the hearing on Senate Bill 628. I'm going to open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I move the Senate Bill 628 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przyansky moves Senate Bill 628 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'm concerned about the fact I don't have an objection to agencies sharing information among themselves, I guess. But what I do have a little bit of a problem with is how a person defends himself. I mean, because occasionally, although it's many times a sort of foregone conclusion that given today's investigative techniques and that sort of thing, it's sort of a foregone conclusion that the perpetrator or accused perpetrator is probably guilty. But I do have a little bit of a problem with a person that's been accused of something, and on the occasion that they really aren't guilty, not being able to get access to the information to which they're being accused, and I guess that's why you have talented lawyers, is to work on building the defense around other things such as alibis and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that people that are being accused ought to be able to get information, the information that's being gathered on them, so that they can either dispute it or not dispute it. And so, I mean, I guess I'll support the bill. But I will say I'm not real crazy about it. I think that because that's not being added in, I think that's something that's important.
And, you know, Representative, what I think might be helpful is to actually, and because she's in the room, I'm going to recommend that maybe you sit down with Susan Russell and have her walk you through what records they do and don't get access to when they're in the discovery process, when one's defending themselves in a criminal prosecution. From prosecution under these kinds of cases, and she'll be able to explain to you exactly what the defense is allowed to get access to during that process. And it is, you know, there are different levels here in a child abuse situation. I mean, DHS does collect certain information that may be simply around making sure that the child is being kept safe, and then the stuff related to what you do with the adult who's been accused of the abuse That's handled, obviously, by the investigation, by the law enforcement folks, and ultimately then by the district attorney's office for prosecution purposes. And Ms. Russell can sort of walk you through, and you'll be willing to do that, right, Susan? Walk you through how a person does get access to the things that are being used against them for purposes of making those allegations.
Maybe DHS is where my concern lies. I'm not sure, but
well, and if you sit down with her, I think that'll narrow. And counsel will commit to you that he'll spend some time lining up whoever you need to come in and satisfy you, ultimately on this subject matter in general.
Okay.
That, is that satisfactory?
That would be fine. Because the other aspect relative to this is licensing boards, and our licensing boards have basically full ability to go out and gather whatever information they want to, although they don't have to share any of that with the accused when there's a malpractice sort of issue or an impropriety sort of issue being charged against a person that holds some kind of a license, whether it's a dental license or an athletic training license or a nurse's license or whatever. And so I think that's something that's important. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Did you make the motion, Representative Brzezinski?
I did.
Okay. So the motion is to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll.
Ackerman.
Excuse.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Hummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excuse.
Brzezinski.
Aye.
Gattaway.
Excuse.
Aye.
Senate Bill 628 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Finally, then, we will take up... Excuse me?
Carrier.
Oh, carrier on that bill.
I'll do that if you want.
Do you want to do that one, Representative Brzezinski?
If you'd like, I'd be glad to.
Yeah, that's fine. Finally, then, we'll take up Senate Bill 426.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 426 adds to the assault in third degree statute. Assault in third degree is a C felony, subject to 5 years. $100,000 maximum fine. It is a 6 on the sentencing guidelines. And maybe I should go run and get a sentencing guidelines. I always forget to bring them so we know what that means. But it would add so that if you intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause a physical injury to another person who is employed by a local government to enforce parking regulations, and the injury occurs in the course of the person's employment.
Ms. Schneider, do you want to come up? So we're expanding crime of assault in the third degree to include
parking patrol deputies. Parking patrol, yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is...
You know, when Representative Barker was a young cop, they referred to those people as meter maids. I don't think they call them that anymore. Isn't that right, Representative?
That is true.
You get shot for saying
they were meter maids.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Susan.
Quite all right. Susan Schneider with the City of Portland, and we're here in support of this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. As counsel indicated, it would make physical assault causing injury to the parking deputy while in the course of their job, third-degree assault, a felony, and provide some degree of protection currently provided by law to bus drivers, taxi drivers, youth correction facility staff, paramedics, and children under 10. The bill is supported by the Multnomah County DA's office. As a result of the nature of their work, parking patrol deputies, as I'm sure you all know, are placed in hostile environments for people or their passengers who are getting tickets. And our deputies have experienced being pushed, shoved, grabbed by drivers and passengers, having cars have to run them over. They have things thrown at them, beer bottles, food, all sorts of things they've had. Planters full of growing things dropped from stories above, and they're often obviously threatened verbally regularly, but we're dealing with the physical aspect here. And because these assaults are misdemeanors, they're not usually prosecuted. And what we're really talking about is outrageous behavior, and we think this needs to change. And so in those few cases where there is really outrageous behavior, we would like to see this established as a felony to ensure that the violators can be prosecuted and the word gets out that that's not okay. So thank you for this opportunity to address this issue, and we hope you can support this bill.
Okay. Are there questions for Ms. Schneider on the bill? Counsel.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Representative Przanski.
Thanks for the elevation.
Well, I was calling you counsel like we were...
Get the glasses.
You know, sitting at the table with each other.
I'm wondering, Susan, you and I have talked about this, and I've told you I've got some opposition to expanding mm-hmm. this to this area.
Yeah.
You've mentioned in your testimony, what I hear is push, shove, which are, at this point, just from what you've said, would not even be a Class A misdemeanor. They would be a Class B misdemeanor as harassment. Because unless there's actual injury occurring, you would not reach the level of an assault for. You've also seen a few cases where this has actually occurred. Do you have documentation as to how often these individuals are actually physically injured?
I don't. Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I do not. I am aware that there are a few cases, and by a few, I believe it's under 10, where we have had workers' compensation claims as a result of injuries. So there certainly are injuries occasionally. That's basically what we're talking about.
Thank you.
Okay. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Crowell.
Susan, so when the people that go out and pick up the money from the meters, if they happen to be assaulted, or a robbery occurs, somebody tries to steal the quarters, would that fall under this particular statute, or would that be under a different statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it is our intent that would be under a different statute. This is for the parking patrol deputies themselves. Normally, people who are collecting the money aren't in a hostile environment. It's not.
They're armed.
Okay.
What's that?
They're armed. The people picking up the money are armed.
Armed.
Yeah.
So then they just shoot
yeah.
the rabbit
and they're not
attacks them. Oh, okay.
Anything else? Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Ms. Russell, you're up.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're just here in a general opposition to Senate Bill 426 in terms of it. And I guess when I say general, we appreciate the concerns and some hostilities that parking lot parking attendants parking, I'm not sure what the...
parking patrol.
Parking patrol, that the parking patrol individuals face. But I think the response that, you know, we kind of hear when we expand is that the authorities don't take misdemeanor prosecution significantly seriously, meaning the authorities, that the district attorneys don't pay enough attention or aren't prosecuting these cases. And we do have a concern and an objection to the idea that we just elevate things to a felony because they'll get more attention when they get prosecuted. It is, I think, the behavior, some of the behavior that is described wouldn't be elevated because there isn't sufficient physical injury to constitute a misdemeanor, even if it's aggravated, to be a felony. But that assault in the first assault in the fourth degree as a Class A misdemeanor, we do feel is an appropriate penalty, and that the answer to it not being prosecuted is to look and see what's going on and why it isn't being prosecuted, and to address issues of funding if that is the issue, rather than simply elevate it to a felony in the hopes that once it's a felony, it'll be prosecuted more aggressively. And that's our concern.
All right. Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Susan. Okay, I'm going to close. Well, let me ask. Anybody else here on this bill? Mr. Powell, you don't have anything on this one? All right. At some point, we're going to subpoena Mr. Powell to come up and testify in front of this committee on something.
My office is actually putting the subpoena together.
Good. I appreciate it.
Are you giving him immunity?
I think he's been here once.
All right, I'm going to close. No, I don't think he testified.
He walked out as soon as we noticed he was in the room.
Yeah, I'm going to close the hearing on this bill, and I don't think we're going to go to work session on it today, colleagues, and I think that completes our agenda for the afternoon. So we're at now.
And I meant to announce...